Our next item is most appropriately entitled Building the Dream. And then collection development at your national library. Mr. Silkey came to our convention for the first time in 1974, and he's been to everyone since. He is the most able director of a library for the blind in the world. He has with him the head of the collection development section of the National Library Service for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. This is Ed O'Reilly. It is a genuine pleasure to welcome these gentlemen to our podium. Mr. Silkey is a good librarian. He is also a good friend. Here is Mr. Silkey, Frank Kurt Silkey.
Thank you, Martin. Well, I thank you very much, Mr. President. I do have, I believe, some important news for you today, but I have two things I'd like to do before I begin my presentation. I'd like to acknowledge, as usual, the staff who have joined me here this week. Lloyd Rasmussen, our acting head of our engineering department. I think that's very important for you to hear, acting head of our engineering department. Debbie Brown, who's our Braille QA specialist. We had John Hansen and Mary Dell Jenkins, who are the music librarians and music specialists. Judy Dixon, and you'll hear from Ed O'Reilly. So we have six representatives here at some time during the week. The second thing I have to say is that we'd be delighted, Ed and I and Lloyd would be delighted to meet with you in the Rosetta Room at 12:15, and we can have a conversation that can last as long as you'd like about our activity. But now I'm going to just give many, many thanks and kudos and whatever the adjectives are to your president, to Jean Perret, and to every single one of you who made the funding of our program, and I say our program, meaning yours and ours, possible. While it's not over, it's very important for you to know, and I'm sure that most of you do, but to realize that in the end of our financial search, the Congress, the House subcommittee marked up actually more money than we needed and cited the NFB as the reason for doing that. Now I will just say a few words and let Ed, and we'll meet later. However, I stand before you today saying we are actually in the digital world. We have signed a contract for the production of the machine. We have signed it with you'll have to excuse my pronunciation here, the Shinano Kensei Company of Ueda City, Japan, and the Shinano Kensei Corporation of Plexstor of Culver City, California. Probably you know them as Plexstor. With the contract, the initial contract was for $35,013,260. And for this, we will receive $217,637. I've never given you these statistics before. Production players, as well as 5,400 pre-launch players. In talking with the Plexstor people on Monday of this week, they indicate that they believe, and this is not a firm promise. We said we'd do it in 2008. and by that I meant the last day in December 2008, they said that they could meet it by November with the first pilot machines. So we are here. These may be mundane things to you, but I think they're very important. We've also signed a contract to have our cartridge containers made, the things that will be shipped in the mail. And that's a $500,000 contract, and they will go on. And they will absolutely be ready at that time. And by the end of next week, we should have a contract for the cartridges or the flash players. So things have gone on quite well. We're on schedule. But I want to tell you, it's been a long, and as well as you know, a long task. But working with many, many people, and absolutely with the National Federation of the Blind, I think together we can say that we are approaching a victory. And before the end of this year, many of you will have in your hands the actual players themselves. Now, the contract with Flexdoor has add-on years, so there's a possibility of a 7-year relationship, and that's a long time, and a lot of machines. And with the help that you gave us, we will be able to reach machine for everybody, hopefully within a 4-year period. The money is for 3, but it'll take 4 years to produce these machines, and we're absolutely there. Just a touch on the download. We appreciate everybody who participated in the download. The download program will be open to the general public as soon as we receive the first shipment of machines. Those machines will be free, as you know. Up until now, you had to purchase machines if you wish to do it, but we're there. So I don't want to take any more time from Ed, but I want to say thank you, Mark Maurer. Thank you, John Perret. Thank you, every member of the NFB, for doing what you did, and your library program is forging on ahead, and I really appreciate being here again this year. Now, with that, I'm going to introduce Ed O'Reilly. And I wrote a few things here, but I think, you know, our time is a bit tight. So if you really want to appreciate the real Ed O'Reilly, you have to come to the atrium at 12:15. Ed has an extensive literary background. He has a doctorate in folklife studies. I think he has a personality that's attentive to everyone, has well-balanced judgment. He is just the well-rounded person fitting into the well-rounded whole. Now, when I say that, Ed is 6 foot tall, weighs 150 pounds. He looks like a bamboo shoot. And so I'm talking about his intellectual capacity, not his physical capacity. Ed?
Thanks very much. Mr. Silkey, Dr. Maurer, NFB members, thanks for having me. I'm 6'5", actually. The digital talking book machine in a prototype version, by the way, if anyone wants to examine it, is on display in the exhibit hall. I think there are only a few hours remaining of the exhibits, but there are two samples there. And it's working good, as they say in used car ads. I'm very, very delighted and interested to be here. This is my first NFB convention. They talk in hushed voices around the campfires at night about NFB conventions, and it's all true. You guys have it together, and I of course, working at the National Library Service for a number of years in several different capacities, have heard a lot about the NFB. And my introduction, I think, was from three of our members, Lloyd Rasmussen, Debbie Brown, and Tom Bickford, who used to sing some of the great songs that that you guys have that always reminded me of the old Union songs from the 1930s that made it possible for workers to get the money they deserved in many cases and improved mine and factory safety and so on and so on. And you guys are doing many of the same things today. The Bards of Taylor Street in one guise, also the Cane Raisers, they were known as. I want to give you a little glimpse behind the scenes. I was standing in the director's office one morning about 6 months ago, and probably getting something signed or receiving party line on policy matters or finding out if we were funded sufficiently to buy binder clips. And he informed me that I was going to speak at NFB. He said they haven't met the new head of collection development. That's me, and that would be a good thing if we met collectively. He said, "What do you want to call your speech? Into the digital future?" He said, "No, we used that at the annual conference." He said, "Facing the digital millennium?" No, that's too apocalyptic. We don't want to offend the secular humanists. He said, "How about building the dream?" Yeah, that's good. Building the dream. So what do you want to call your speech? I hesitated and I said, how about building the dream? And the director said, that's good, I like it. So this is about building the dream. It has nothing to do with Cary Grant's architectural misadventures in Mr. Blanding's Build His Dream House, and it has very little to do with Martin Luther King's vision of equity, although insofar as that was touched upon by our last speaker, it's all of a piece. And it has nothing to do with Shakespeare's Arcadian revelry in the forest outside of Athens. In fact, I don't know exactly what the director had in mind, but I've got an idea or two of my own. There are a couple of dreams that we work on, and one is the dream that's animated the National Library Service from the very start, and that's easy to define. It's to support the aspirations and, more important, the rights of blind folks and visually impaired people and people with physical disabilities of this nation to have the same access to books and printed materials as any other member of the society. And since we came together more or less in our present form back in the 1930s, I think we can claim some success in making this happen or helping to make it happen. We have a good collection currently of more than 73,000 recorded book titles and 61,000 Braille items. I think 10 or 12,000 of those are now available on Web Braille. And Web Braille is growing every day, and that's a part of the digital revolution that's somewhat unsung. We're so chuffed, as they say in England, about the machine contract and the digital audio that's going to be available in the next months. That we sometimes shunt Braille aside when we talk about our program, and I think we shouldn't do that. I know that I support Judy Dixon, who is the director once called her the mother of Web Braille, in her efforts to promulgate Web Braille, and I think it's a dazzling phenomenon. We also have something like 19,000 music scores and maybe 1,400 print Braille books, mostly for kids. We have magazines, tactile maps, and there's access to much, much more through the portal of our union catalog. I think we're prepared to admit that interlibrary loan, especially internationally, isn't as dependable as we might wish and not as speedy as the Pony Express or even the average three-toed sloth. But the libraries try, and patience is generally rewarded. Patience, I know that the last speaker was advocating immediacy, and I appreciate that, but patience is a prerequisite for government work. Also for book collecting and book acquisition and for fishing and bird watching and courtship. So I think there's a place for both attitudes. We currently have in Washington about 120 people, which is a somewhat reduced staff. We're working to remedy that. Plus the staffs of the wonderful great network of libraries around the country that are making all this happen. And by all this, I mean the production of new books and the circulation in an ordinary year of something like 27 million items. This is an inconceivable number to me, but that's, as they say, the stuff that dreams are made of. There's some not-so-good news mixed in here. The number of libraries in our network is smaller than it used to be. I think it's down to from almost 20 from when I started in the early 90s. Governments from the federal down through the state and local are chopping discretionary funds for all kinds of enrichment activities, inessential things like reading, education, art, music, you know. And it's not just blind folks who are getting hit in this way. It's the war on art, culture, reading, and education is waged democratically. And only the well-to-do are accepted. Sometimes it seems as if they have other interests, like golf or destabilizing small autocracies or burrowing through their money like Uncle Scrooge. As you may know, we select and produce about 2,500 books annually, and that breaks down into audio and braille, around 2,000 audio books and 500 to 600 braille books. The reason for the discrepancy, a cassette book with a container costs a little more than $5 a copy, and a braille book costs close to $100 a copy. We could bring that down a bit with massive production, but the fact of the matter is only about 5% of our enrollment consists of braille readers. I know that there are people here who would hope to change that. And there's another fact that's I don't know whether it's sad or disturbing or maybe just fascinating. I'm not sure, but the number of books published in the United States annually is staggering. We used to say that there were around 40% published, we used to say that around 40,000 books were published annually in the United States, so that at 2,000 books a year, we could claim we skimmed off 5% for the program, which is consistent with the number that I think Dr. Rowland gave. But the number isn't 40,000. It's much higher than that. It's somewhere between 200,000 and 300,000 books. And that means that at 2,500 books a year, we're doing something like 2/3 of 1%. Of what's published annually. And it's amazing to me that that we can make anyone happy at all. The news is not all bad, though, and the more I think about the digital future, the more encouraged I am about the prospects for reading. We've been promised and have promised in turn a great deal of the digital revolution. And I think it's important to remain patient, as I said, because we're not just in the midst of a consumer innovation like the introduction of instant pudding at the supermarket, but rather we're making our way into a whole new way of life and thought. digital books, whether online or on flash memory cartridges, are just a start. And in time, maybe after some of us, including me, are long gone, reading itself may have new and different meanings. There's a huge literature accumulating on the subject of the postmodern world and the digital age. And maybe we'll talk some about that in the meeting at the in the Rosetta Room at 12:15. I hope you'll all, some of you anyway, at least some of you, can't all, but some of you will come to that and we'll have a good conversation. There's a story, speaking of the of bad news, there's this wonderful story called In the Penal Colony by Franz Kafka. And in that story, prisoners who have misbehaved in this in an imaginary penal colony are strapped down to a kind of a mattress. The machine is out in the middle of a field, and they're strapped to this mattress face down, and a felt plug is put in their mouths to stop them from screaming, and from up above, descending toward their backs, is a series of glass, very incredibly sharp brass glass hooks. And the hooks descend slowly and begin to move. And as they touch the back of the prisoner who's being punished, they begin to write many of these hooks. They write in unison. And they write something like, "I will not be insubordinate," or "I will not question authority." And the top part of the machine presses down ever deeper. And Kafka says sometimes after they're about halfway through the prisoner's body, he's able to decipher the actual message. And when they're all the way through, he's definitely got the message, and the machine goes back to reboot, and the prisoner is kicked over into a pit. In case you missed the point, it's words and writing used as a tool of oppression. On the other hand, there's the image of Annie Sullivan writing in Helen Keller's hand and turning her from an animal into a civilized human being. So, thank you very much.